And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we are going to be talking about.
They could be the richest country in all of Europe. I don't want to give that money and those assets to Putin to share with China.
So there you go. Forget democracy. He's talking about Ukraine, by the way. Forget democracy. Forget the destruction of Ukraine. Forget the thousands of people who are dead or dying. Senator Lindsey Graham explains the real reason for this country, America's involvement in Ukraine. And the reason is, da-da-da-da-da, money. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do it. You know, it's always been known, even by some of the friends that I have who went and fought in Iraq, and a lot of them came back and we became buddies. These are like, you know, hoo-ha military guys. And they always said, you know what the real reason that we went over there? The real reason that we were in Iraq? It had to do with the fact that Iraq was a country that was so rich in resources and brimming with oil fields. This is what the guys who went over there and fought came back and told me as a reporter when we'd talk, or even just as friends. But now I ask myself, and I'm sure you probably asked yourselves too, could the same thing be said of our current involvement in Ukraine? Well, Viktor Orban seems to think so. I want you to listen to how boldly he tells it. Well, tells it like it is, essentially calling out his NATO member colleagues. Here's what he says. He says, and I'm going to quote him, right? He says, the fact that the Western warmongering leaders want to defeat Russia in this war, and the reason is rather simple. He says, right there, money. Now, he's not making a lot of friends in NATO, as you might imagine, for saying that. They're mad at him for saying that. But, and then you're probably thinking, okay, so that's Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, right? Certainly no U.S. leader would be willing to say something like that, right? No way somebody here in this country, not a congressman, a senator, maybe somebody in the White House. No, they would never say that, right? Well, actually, there is someone who actually does admit it. Here's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham accidentally telling the truth while being interviewed just the day before yesterday on CBS. Here it is.
They're sitting on $10 to $12 trillion of critical minerals in Ukraine. They could be the richest country in all of Europe. I don't want to give that money and those assets to Putin to share with China. If we help Ukraine now, they can become the best business partner we ever dreamed of.
So we're doing all of this because we want to create a business partnership with Ukraine. So there you go, Manila. We got to keep this war going because we need those resources. Sometimes in life, the truth just accidentally slips out. You know what I mean?
Oh, Rick, we are on a roll this week with the accidental truth bombs coming out of the nation's capital, right? First, with Matt Miller at the State Department. Now we hear Senator Graham. Let's not forget, though, Rick, that he, along with his Senate soulmate, John McCain, were part of the Ukraine Destruction Committee. Now, I don't think that was their official name, but my point is they've been at this since around 2012. McCain didn't live long enough to see the fruits of his labor realized, but Graham's statements this week about Ukraine's vast natural resources are probably the most honest thing he has ever said. It's never been about freedom or democracy or Western values or whatever else they were parroting to manufacture consent for war to the American people. America never engages in that sort of thing for free or for, you know, out of the goodness of our hearts. There has to be something in it for us. We were in it for the natural resources. That's always been true in modern times, Rick. I mean, that's why we keep so friendly with Saudi Arabia.
But to say it out there so loud and so blatantly is fascinating. And now his words are being heard all over the world. Speaking of words being heard all over the world, Tucker Carlson has just posted a fascinating interview on his website with Thomas Massey. I don't know if you've seen that. He is the U.S. congressman who is from Kentucky. Massey is actually one of the few politicians who has decided that he is not going to take any money at all, as a matter of fact, from AIPAC, the lobby that represents the interests of Israel. And because of that, AIPAC has targeted him and attempted to take him out. I mean, here he is describing to Tucker how his colleagues in Congress say they feel bad for him because of what the Israeli lobby is doing to him. Here it is.
Why have Republicans who come to me on the floor and say, I wish I could vote with you today. Yours is the right vote, but I would just take too much flack back home. And I have Republicans who come to me and say, that's wrong what AIPAC is doing to you. Let me talk to my AIPAC person. By the way, everybody but me has an AIPAC person.
What does that mean, an AIPAC person?
It's like your babysitter, your AIPAC babysitter, who is always talking to you for AIPAC. They're probably a constituent in your district, but they are, you know, firmly embedded in AIPAC.
Have you seen any other country do anything like this? Like
no.
Russia obviously determines the outcome of our elections. We keep hearing that. Does anyone have a Putin guy that they talk to?
Not only do they not have a Putin guy, look, they don't have a Britain guy. They don't have an Australian guy. They don't have a Germany dude.
You know, I can't play the entire interview, but I got to tell you, his description of the total control on almost all of Congress, and he's in it. I mean, this guy's an insider, right? That's applied by AIPAC is nothing short of crazy. AIPAC is by far the lobby that gives the most amount of money to all members of the U.S. Congress, more than any U.S. industry, for example. And what they're lobbying for has nothing to do with the United States of America. I mean, this is nuts. By the way, the majority of AIPAC's funding comes from extremely wealthy Zionist corporate investors, CEOs, and other heavy hitters. It does not come from, nor does it seem to represent, the average American Jewish citizen. Although the corporate media would have you think that's what it actually represents. Now, I think that's a really important point in this conversation, and what came out as I was watching that interview that my friend Tucker did with Congressman Massey. Manila, your take.
Yeah, Rick, that was just nuts to hear. I mean, think about that. There are 435 members of the House. That means there's more than 400 lobbyists or handlers dedicated solely to the issue of Israel. Now, look, I don't know what the average Jewish American thinks or that they support all the actions of AIPAC, but what I do know from having been a field reporter and having been assigned to the campaign trail during the 2016 elections is that the average American isn't concerned with the interests of Israel. They're interested in being able to afford rent, to buy food for their families, put gas in their car, and just living in a peaceful community. They don't like war. And generally, they're just nice people out there across America. I never asked their religious affiliation or their ethnic identities. But not once, Rick, not once on the trail in 2016 did I hear any random person that I talked to ever even bring up Israel as an important issue to them. So it's really inexplicable to me that, you know, they have the breadth of reach that they do, that AIPAC does within our government.
And that's the point. They represent the foreign policy of another country, while here in this country, and not so much the opinions of the average American Jew, which is no different than the average American Cuban or the average American anything, as a matter of fact, which is why I mentioned that, because I happen to be Cuban.
Exactly.
All right, let's get to the next one before people are saying Jews and Cubans, whatever. All right, seems the media here in the United States is obsessed, isn't it, with finding racism in every story they report, even where it doesn't seem to exist. I got a case in point for you. This story that has apparently captivated the internet. It's all over the place. Go to YouTube, you'll see it everywhere. It's a story about some dude, some man, who stops the school superintendent from shaking hands with his daughter during graduation. Here it is.
This video, broadcast online and on TV, shows Matthew Eddy, pictured here in white, push Superintendent Rainey Briggs before Briggs could shake the hand of Eddy's daughter.
Excuse me.
Where's Brendan?
Eddie told investigators he pushed the superintendent away from his daughter because he thought Briggs treated her unfairly when she got in trouble at school. But some online called the behavior racist, as Briggs is black and Eddie is white. Representative Francesca Hong from Madison taking to X to write, "No one should have to endure this type of gross and racist conduct." The district, in a statement, not addressing the accusations of racism, but saying it's, quote, taking this incident very seriously and working closely with local law enforcement to ensure a thorough investigation.
I cannot believe I just saw that. And it happens. So some people online say Manila robbed the bank, so I'm going with it. So listen, even though they quote the father, I don't know if you can tell in the report, so let me take you back through it in case you missed it. So the father says he had a beef with the superintendent for what apparently the superintendent did to his daughter at some point, right? They then suggest the assault was racist. Why? Because some people online, including some woman that no one's ever heard of, says so. Now, obviously, the father's a jerk, right? And he's acting like a jerk, and he was way out of line to do what he did. But is he a racist simply because he's white and the other guy is black? I mean, it seems to me that's what they're saying. And yes, our corporate media seems to be obsessed with this kind of thing, jumping to conclusions that aren't necessarily there. My take, what's yours?
No, I agree with that part. I'm glad you brought this up, made that distinction. Journalistically, that's important to underscore that there was actually more to the story, more to that visual right. of what we saw. White dad, black school faculty. But if you ask me, I still don't support what the dad did there.
No.
Teenage girls, Rick, you have a daughter. Teenage, especially girls, are already so embarrassed by their parents' actions. You can see in the girl's face how mortified she was. Then to find out that this story went viral and went national. I mean, the poor girl, she's now probably traumatized by this spectacle. She's now always going to be that girl. The damage is done, though, to her and her dad yeah. and the superintendent, whether or not racism was a component there. This was a moment for the girl to have a grown-up moment in her life if she chose to shake the superintendent's hand or not. That should have been her call and dad's intervention. I say, Rick, taking that, he took the agency away from her.
You're absolutely right. This has nothing to do with that, though. I mean, the dad was a jerk. He shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have hit the superintendent.
He shouldn't have pushed him.
Shouldn't have been. All of those are correct. But that has nothing to do. What if the guy was white? What if the guy was Asian? What if the guy was Hispanic?
Right. It wouldn't be a story.
It wouldn't be a story. You can't just say because one person is one color and another person is another color
right.
that's the reason for the confrontation because somebody online suggested it. That's crazy.
Right.
And the moment we start doing
that's an important distinction.
Absolutely. And I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it.
We can dislike each other, Rick, and be different colors, but dislike each other for every reason other than the color.
Yeah.
That's important.
But that's what they do, especially at the corporate level. If you watch CNN or Fox or Univision or any of that, that's what you see all the time, unfortunately.
Rick, by the way, I went to college with a kid that was both Cuban and Jewish. We called him a Jubin.
Yeah. I've heard that before as well. Thanks for letting us know. Thanks, Manila. Always a fun conversation with you. By the way, this is smart. When we come back, why did Syria become the disaster that it has become? I mean, think Presidents Obama and Trump and Biden. What did they do right? What did they do wrong? And why? I want to know. And I've got the perfect guest to ask all the questions for that. His name is Kevork Almasyan. He has a podcast on YouTube. It's called Syriana Analysis. It is both informative and very popular. And he's going to join us from Berlin after the break. Don't go away.
Since the beginning of its history, the United States of America has officially declared the striving for freedom and people's right to happiness. However, in reality, having won independence, American colonists headed for the total extermination of the indigenous population of the continent. American Indians were deprived of their land. Local residents were driven into reservations and given the worst agricultural territories, while the best land was appropriated by white colonizers. The strongest blow to American Indian tribes was the extermination of bison. Native Americans lived by hunting these wild animals. Colonists slaughtered the bison and, in fact, made them nearly extinct. "Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone," said Colonel Richard Dodge, a veteran of the bloody and vicious Indian wars, cynically. The indigenous population was simply exterminated. U.S. Army General Philip Sheridan expressed the essence of this policy in the infamous words, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." The genocide of Native Americans of North America led to a demographic catastrophe. The exact number of deaths is still unknown, but the number of victims is in millions. Having been the majority on the continent before, the indigenous people make up less than 3% of the U.S. population today.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez, and joining us now to discuss, as promised, is Kavora Kalamassian. He is the host of Syriana Analysis. And we thank you so much, Kavork, for taking time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, let's start with how this all began. I guess what? Between 2011 and 2014, all hell breaks loose after the Arab Spring. And apparently people are angry, which is normal. People get angry in all kinds of countries, including our own. But how does that turn into the catastrophe that we then got? And why did this country, the United States, decide that it had to go all in?
Actually, if we follow the mainstream press and the politicians in the United States, of course, they are involved in the Syrian conflict to bring democracy, human rights, and to liberalize our societies. So if you believe them, then this is your issue. However, there are major issues why the United States wanted to replace President Bashar al-Assad or to conduct covert operations which could lead into a coup similar to what happened in Ukraine, for example, in 2014. The reason is, of course, Israel. Syria is considered the quote-unquote strategic depth of what is called the axis of resistance in West Asia. And this axis includes state and non-state actors that stretch from Iran to Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Palestine. So Syria played an instrumental role in terms of the military support and intelligence support to Palestinian and Lebanese armed groups to support them in their armed struggle against the Israeli occupation forces. So this was an enough reason for the Americans to attempt to coup Assad and install a puppet government in Damascus in order to end this flow of weapons, also training and intelligence support to these non-state actors fighting against the Israeli occupation forces. However, there were other two main factors in this case. The other factor was, for example, the Americans wanted to remove the Russian fleet from the Mediterranean, similar to what they attempted to do in the Black Sea. So if we remember what happened in 2014 after the coup, one of the first steps that the new regime that was installed by Victoria Nuland and the other gangs in Washington, D.C., they wanted to remove the Russian fleet from the Black Sea. So similarly, they wanted to do in Syria to remove the Russian fleet from the Mediterranean, and therefore the Russians had an invested interest, for example, in capturing Crimea and also capturing, not capturing, but coming to Syria for help. And that's how they preserved their the fleet, not only in the Mediterranean, but also in the Black Sea. And this is very important if we think about it geopolitically, that the Russians now have a free access between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, and they can exert their power on the world. The third reason, in my opinion, this is very important because it's also related to Russia, it's gas. So the Qataris in 2008 offered Assad that they could extend gas pipelines from Qatar passing through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Turkey. And from Turkey, Turkey will distribute this gas to Europe. So the reason was to end the project of Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. And Assad, because he was an ally of Russia, and he thought about it, and he said, no, he's not going to allow Qatari gas pipelines to be extended through the territories of Syria. And therefore, you see the excitement of Qatar and Turkey in removing Assad from power after 2011, because they had a huge invested interest, economic interest, and see what happened after the 2022 conflict in Ukraine. The Americans couldn't end this project through a Qatari pipeline, so they hit it directly, and they ended the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by blowing it up, and then they blame it to a pro-Ukrainian group, which is, in my opinion, the CIA.
So fascinating. You have given us three interesting explanations for the true reason for the United States getting so heavily involved in Syria, more than many other places where there were also Arab Springs. You mentioned, of course, Israel wanting to fight back against Russia's access there. And then, of course, taking on Assad, who they've never liked to begin with. But let me back up a little bit and try and defend the country from which I speak right now, the United States of America. Their point of view is, okay, there's an Arab Spring. The people that are in Syria hate their president. They want democracy, and we're going to go in and help them get that. You're saying that's a great story, but it's really a pretense for what they wanted to do. Am I reading you correctly?
Exactly. Of course, President Bashar al-Assad had popularity in Syria. He was popular among many sectors of the Syrian society, and he had also haters. It's normal, like in any other country. However, the foreign meddling in Syria started through what is called the civil society. So the Americans have provided, including my friends and colleagues in the university and in school that I know them, with the technologies and with the tools, necessary training, so that they know how to protest, how to gather in the streets, and how to fight against the government. Yeah. However, during these times, there were lots of killing happening as well. In early days of 2011, there were also infiltrators in the among the demonstrators. And this is a similar story happened in Ukraine when the snipers shot on both sides, the security, the military, yeah, and also the protesters, in order to create a chaos. Because when chaos happens, you can break the status quo and try to reform it. But they have misread it, because Syria has been built on a very strong security apparatus and also military power. Therefore, their assumption that Assad will leave power in 3 months, this was a big miscalculation, and it was a wishful thinking. So when they realized they cannot remove Assad from power after 3 months, they started arming the radical jihadists in Syria. And this is, we have an evidence for that, because in 2012, the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States submitted a report to President Obama, the former president of the United States, telling him that the driving force against Assad in the country are the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. And he knowingly put his signature on a CIA covert operation called Timber Sycamore and sent the CIA to Syria in order to arm these jihadists, in order to train them. And eventually,
what you're saying is the United States was working side by side with Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
That's definitely the case. In 2012, Jake Sullivan, who is now the National Security Advisor, back then he was the aide of Hillary Clinton, he sent an email to Hillary Clinton telling her that she was the Secretary of State. I'm quoting him, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. And in 2021, James Jeffrey, who was the U.S. Special Envoy to Syria, he had an interview, and I'm literally quoting him now. He says that Al-Jolani is an asset. Al-Jolani is the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria. He said that Al-Jolani was an asset of the U.S. strategy in Syria. I mean, the entire operation in Turkey, which they had two military operation rooms, one in Turkey and one in Jordan. And these military operation rooms, they have guided and instructed and helped and supported and funded and armed all these jihadists in Syria. But unlike, for example, if you remember what happened now in Ukraine, they say that they will lift the ban on arming Azov battalion, and because they couldn't do it in their faces, but right. in the face of the world.
It's a wonderful comparative analysis that you're doing. All of a sudden, the United States is saying the Azov battalion, who they've always called neo-Nazis, are okay, just like they once said, well, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who are bad, are okay because they're necessary. That's. Let me ask you about Trump. Trump did something interesting toward the end of administration. The hawks in the State Department wanted him to continue to keep troops and go harder in Syria. And he made a decision, or tried at least, to get the troops out. Tell me about that and what it means, and was he right? And do you think, from a geopolitical standpoint, he would make a better president than Biden in that sense? And I'm sorry to say, we've got about a minute and a half left.
He wanted to leave Syria, and he took the decision to leave Syria, but there was an enormous pressure on him, especially from the Israeli side. The Israelis and the Zionists and the neocons in D.C., they were very, very determined that the Americans should stay there, because once the Americans leave, then Assad will take over the country again, and he will reestablish order and stability, and he will once again be able to actively participate in what's happening in the region,
and especially
in terms of the Palestinian.
He is the president of the country. Why are we telling the people who they should be led by when it's not our country? Am I crazy to ask that?
Because that's the definition of imperialism. The imperialists think that they have the moral high ground, and they have the authority to tell us who can rule. I'm a Syrian. I was born in Syria, and I am entitled to elect my president or my representative. But the Americans do not believe in national sovereignty. So once they disagree with the president, instead of compromising with him, they just try to coup this president. And the Americans did to Syria many, many times since its independence. The first official coup in Syria happened with the endorsement and the support of the Americans and the CIA. So they have been doing this business for a very long time. This is nothing new, actually, for the Syrians. But now the Syrians have a collective memory, and that's why they have fought against this project. And they fought the regime change project, but they didn't win yet this long war against the American imperialism.
We're going to get you back. I need to continue this conversation because we didn't talk about chemical weapons. We didn't talk about Obama's actual role. We didn't talk about a lot of things that I wish we had an opportunity to continue talking about. But look, these kinds of conversations are important because we're trying to tell the stories that unfortunately much of the world never hears, because much of the world gets their news from very corporatized Western sources. Someone like you can open our eyes to, if nothing else, people might disagree with much of what you said, but it's a different perspective, and certainly from a Syrian inside that we never get to hear. So my thanks to you for sharing
that
with us. And congratulations and good luck with your podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
My pleasure, in fact. Thank you so much. That's our show. Remember, always look out your own box when you're looking for truth. That's what we try to do. That's what that conversation just represented. Many of the things you would never hear anywhere else. Maybe outside your box, their box. I'm Rick Sanchez. It's what we do. And I'll see you next time.